Travel Scraps 1. London, Summer 1896. All over the world there seems to be a prejudice against the cab driver, but that is too sweeping. It must be modified. I think I may say that there is a prejudice against him in many American cities, but not in Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Boston. That in Europe, as a rule, there is a prejudice against him, but not in Munich and Berlin. That there is a prejudice against him in Calcutta, but not in Bombay. I think I may say that the prejudice against him is strong in London, stronger in Paris, and strongest in New York. There are courteous and reasonable cabmen in Paris, but they seem to be rare. I think that in London, 4 out of every 6 cabmen are pleasant and rational beings, and are satisfied with 25% above legal fare, and that the other 2 are always ready and anxious for a dispute, and burning to conduct it in a loud and frantic key. Note, if you call a policeman to settle the dispute, you can depend on one thing, he will decide it against you every time, and so will the New York policeman. In London, if you carry your case into court, the man that is entitled to win it will win it. In New York, but no one carries a cab case into court there. It is my impression that it is now more than 30 years since anyone has carried a cab case into court there. The foreigner is charged the wildest of prices, but the hotel keeper advises him to pay and keep quiet, and assures him that the court will of a certainty side with the hackman. The citizen must pay from 2 to 3 prices when he makes his bargain beforehand, and more when he doesn't. When he makes his bargain beforehand, he expects to be overcharged and is not discontented unless the overtax is extravagant, because he knows that the legal rate is too low and that the hack industry cannot live upon it. The heavy overcharge has kept the traffic down and made it meager. The legal charge might not be too low if the traffic were as heavy as it ought to be for a city like New York, but it is not likely to expand while hackmen may continue to charge any price they please. And now that the hacks have driven all the business into the hands of the steam and electric companies, the periodical attempts to inaugurate a cheap hack system in New York will presently begin again, I suppose. Hacks are but little needed in American cities for any but strangers who cannot find their way by tram lines. The citizen should be thankful for the high hack rates which have given him the trams, for by consequence he has the cheapest and swiftest city transportation that exists in the world. London travels by omnibus, pleasant but as deadly slow as a European lift, and by underground railway, which is an invention of Satan himself. It goes no direct course, but always a way around. When the train arrives, you must jump, rush, fly, and swarm with the crowd into the first cigar box that is handy, lest you get left. You have hardly time to mash yourself into a portion of a seat before the train is off again. It goes blustering and scuttering along, puking smoke and cinders in at the window, which someone has opened in pursuance of his right to make the whole cigar box uncomfortable if his comfort requires it. The fog of black smoke smothers the lamp and dims its light, and the double row of jammed people sit there and bark at each other, and the righteous and the unrighteous pray each after his own fashion. The train stops every few minutes, and there is a new rush and scramble each time. And every 1/4 hour you change cars, and fly 30 yards to a stairway, and up the stairway, and 50 yards along a corridor, and down another stairway, and plunge headlong into a train just as it moves off. And of course it is the wrong one, and you must get out at the next station and come back. But it is no matter. If you had stopped to ask the official on duty, it would have been the right train, and you would have lost it by stopping to ask. And so none but idiots stop to ask. The next time that you ought to change cars, you are not aware of it, and you go on. You keep on going, on and on and on, wondering what has become of St. John's Wood, and if you are ever likely to get to that brick-and-mortar forest. And by, you pull your courage together and ask a passenger if he can tell you whereabouts you are. And he says, "We are just arriving at Sloane Square." You thank him and look gratified. Look as gratified as you can on the spur of the moment and without sufficient preparation. And step out, saying, "It is my station." And so it is. That is where you started from. It is an hour or an hour and a half ago, and it is getting toward bedtime now. You have been plowing through tunnels all that time, and have been all around under London amongst its entrails, and been in first, second, and third-class cars on a third-class ticket, and associated with all sorts of company, from dukes and bishops down to rank and mangy tramps and blatherskites who sat with their drunken trunnions in their laps and caressed and kissed them unembarrassed. You have missed the dinner you were aimed for, but You are alive yet, and that is something. And you have learned better than to go by tunnel anymore, and that is also a gain. You cannot telephone your friend to go to bed and not keep the dinner waiting. There is not a telephone within a mile of you, and there is not a telephone within a mile of him. Years ago there was a telephone system in England, but in the country parts it is about dead now, and what is left of it in London has no value. So you send a telegram to your friend stating that you have met with an accident and begging him not to wait dinner for you. You are aware that all the offices in his neighborhood close at 8 in the evening, and it is 10 now. It is also Saturday night, and England keeps Sunday. But the telegram will reach his house Monday morning, and when he gets back from business at 5 in the evening, he will get it, and will know then that you did not come Saturday evening, and why. One little wee bunch of houses in London, one little wee spot, is the center of the globe, the heart of the globe, and the machinery that moves the world is located there. It is called the city, and it, with a patch of its borderland, is a city. But the rest of London is not a city. It is 50 villages massed solidly together over a vast stretch of territory. Each village has its own name and its own government. Its ways are village ways, and the great body of its inhabitants are just villagers, and have the simple, honest, untraveled, unworldly look of villagers. Its shops are village shops. Little cramped places where you can buy an anvil or a paper of pins or anything between, but you can't buy two anvils, nor five papers of pins, nor seven white cravats, nor two hats of the same breed, because they do not keep such gross masses in stock. The shopman will not offer to get the things and send them to you, but will tell you where he thinks you may possibly find them. And he is not brusque and fussy and unpleasant like a city person, but takes the simple and kindly interest of a villager in the matter, and will discuss it as long as you please. They have no hateful city ways, and indeed no ways that suggest that they have ever lived in a city. In my village there are a lot of little post offices, and one big one, in Sloane Square. One Saturday toward dusk I visited three of the little ones and asked if there was a Sunday mail for Paris, and if so, at how late an hour could I mail my letter and catch it? Nobody knew whether there was such a mail or not, but it was believed that there was. They could not refer to a table of mails, for they had none. Could they telephone the general post office and find out for me? No, they had no telephone. The big office in Sloane Square might know. I went there. There were two or three girls and a woman or two on duty. Yes, there was a Paris mail, they said. They did not know at what hour it left, but they believed it did. Were my questions unusual ones in their experience? They could not remember that anyone had asked them before. And those people looked so friendly and innocent and childlike and ignorant and happy and content. I lived 9 months in that village. I got my predecessor's mail along with my own every day. He had left his new address at the post office, but that did little or no good. The letters came to me. I re-instructed the carriers now and then. Then, for as much as a week afterward, I would get my own mail only. After that, I would get the double mail again as before. But that was a pleasant village to live in. The spirit of accommodation was everywhere, just as it is in Germany, and just as it isn't in a good many parts of the earth. I went to my nearest post office one day to send a telegram. The office was in a little shop that had $30 worth of miscellaneous merchandise in it, and a young woman was on duty. I was in a hurry. I wrote the telegram, and the young woman examined it and said she was afraid it would not reach its destination. A flaw in the address, perhaps. I do not remember what the trouble was. She wanted to call her husband and advise about the matter. I explained that I was following orders and that if the man at the other end did not get the telegram, he would have only himself to blame. But she was not satisfied with that. She reminded me that it would be a pure waste of money, and I the loser. She would rather call her husband and see about it. She had to have her way. I could not help myself. Her kindly interest disarmed me, and I could not break out and say, "Oh, just send it as it is and let me go." She brought her husband, and the two reasoned the matter out at considerable length, and finally got it arranged to their satisfaction. But I was not to get away yet. There was a new difficulty. There were apparently more words than necessary, and if I could strike out a word or two, the telegram would cost only sixpence. I came near saying I would rather pay 4 cents extra than lose another 3 shillings worth of time, but it would have been a shame to act like that when they were trying their best to do me a kindness, so I did not say it, but held in and let the ruinous expense of time run on. Amongst us, in the course of time, we managed to gut the telegram of a few of its most necessary words, and then I was free and paid my sixpence and got back to my work. And I would be glad to repeat that pleasant experience, even at cost of half the time and twice the money. That was a London episode. I'm trying to imagine such a thing happening in a New York telegraph office, but there seems to be something the matter with my imagination today. The London bus driver does not seem like a city person, but like a blessed angel out of the country. He is often nattily dressed and nicely shaved, and often just the other way, but in either case the man is a choice man and satisfactory. He hasn't a hard city face, nor crusty and repellent city ways, nor indeed anything about him which can be called citified. That epithet which suggests the absence of all spirituality and the presence of all kinds of paltry materialisms and mean ideals and mean vanities and silly cynicisms. He is a pleasant and courteous and companionable person. He is kindly and conversational. He has a placid and dignified bearing which becomes him well. And he rides serene above the crush and turmoil of London, as undisturbed by it and as unconcerned about it as if he were not aware that anything of the kind was going on. The choice part of the bus is its roof, and the choicest places on the roof are the two seats back of the driver's elbows. The occupants of those seats talk to him all the time. That shows that he is a polite man and interesting, and it shows that in his heart he is a villager, and has the simplicities and sincerities and spirit of comradeship which belong to a man whose city contacts have been of an undamaging infrequency. The bus driver not only likes to talk to his passengers, but likes to have a choice kind of passengers to talk to. I base this opinion upon some remarks made to a friend of mine by a driver toward the end of last February. My friend opened the conversation along in the King's Road somewhere. "I suppose you're glad the winter is about over?" "No, I don't mind the cold weather, but I don't like the road."
"What is the matter with the road?"
"Well, I don't like the society. Just villagers, you know, that's about what they are. Good-hearted and all that, but no style. No conversational powers. Chelsea, Wallham, Green, Battersea, that kind, you know. No intellectual horizon. Dull, honest, sincerely pious and all that, but interested in the triflingest little commonplace things."
"I'm degenerating, I know it. A man can't live on that kind of mental diet and drive a bus."
"Where were you before? Were you better off before?"
"Well, I should think. Hammersmith, Earl's Court, Knightsbridge. There's society. And brains.
Yes, sir, and fashion. Top of the bus looks like a queen's drawing room. And the talk, well, the talk is up high, away up towards the snow line. Away up where, as you may say, your intellectual water boils at 145. That is the ticket. I'm tired boiling mine at 212.
Part of the bus driver's serenity in the midst of the London turmoil springs no doubt from his consciousness of the fact that he and his bus have nothing to fear from collisions, part from his confidence in the steadiness and biddability of his horses, and the rest from the fact that he knows how to steer. Drivers of cabs and carriages know that a collision with a bus is not a desirable thing, and they take pains to avoid it. The bus is English. When that is said, all is said. As a rule, any English thing is 19 times as strong and 23 times as heavy as it needs to be. The bus fills these requirements. It is a lumbering big ark. It weighs no one knows how much, and it minds collision with an ordinary vehicle no more than a planet would. It is a pity they did not keep the first English bicycle. It must have weighed upwards of 3 tons. And if it ever collided with an express train, the remains of the train must have been a spectacle. It is an inspiring thing to see the bus driver steer his ark. He weaves in and out among a writhing swarm of vehicles, just barely missing them by the thickness of a shingle sometimes, sometimes by the thickness of a brick. And while you are doing the gasping and shrinking, he is chatting over his shoulder, and his hands seem to be mainly idle, and himself not interested in anything but his talk. It is wonderful steering, and yet it seems to do itself. It has such an effortless look. Two horses draw the ark, only two, but they are capable. They are strong and sleek and handsome, well kept and well cared for, and on long routes they make but one trip a day. They are brought from America. They cost about $250 apiece. At the end of 3 years they are sold, often for more than they cost originally, and fresh importations take their place.
Here in Vienna, the cab driver ranks as he ranks in all other cities of Europe, as the wittiest person in town, the ablest chaffer, the quickest and brightest at repartee. We always believe that wherever we go, but we have to take it on trust because the instances never chance to fall under our own personal notice. In London, the cabman is noted for his smart sayings, but I did not have the luck to hear them. Many years ago in Liverpool, however that time it was not wit, it was humor. I was there with the late James R. Osgood, and we had several hours to spare and much talking to do. It seemed a good idea to do the talking in a cab and have the fresh air. The cabman asked where we wished to go. Mr. Osgood said, "Oh, just drive around an hour or so, anywhere, we are not particular." The man sat still and waited. Osgood presently asked what he was waiting for, and he said, "I want to know where I am to go." "Why, I told you to go anywhere you pleased." The man looked troubled, puzzled, and worried, but he sat still. Presently Osgood said, "Why don't you start?"
"Dear me, I want to start. I want to start as bad as anybody. But how can I when you won't tell me where you want to go? I've drove for 14 years, and I've never heard of such a thing."
"Oh, do move along. I don't care where you go. Go to Balmoral." We were very busy talking all through these interruptions. We probably started now. After a long time, we woke up out of the talk, and Osgood looked at his watch and said it was getting toward train time. Liverpool was nowhere in sight. We were troubled, and Osgood said, "Driver, what have you been doing? Where are you going?"
"Balmoral, sir."
"Balmoral? What are you going to Balmoral for?"
"Because you told me, sir."
"Because I told you? Did you suppose I was in earnest? How far is it?"
400 miles, sir."
"Well, well, this is a joke. What there is of it, get along back as fast as you can."
"Just as you say, sir."
The man had a pleasant voice and pleasant ways and manners and a good face, a very good face indeed, but a preternaturally grave one. Not melancholy, but just grave, grave and patient. He had probably never smiled in his life. He was not dull, but he was not animated, not excitable. He had the look of one who was given to much thinking and little speaking. By his accent, he was Scotch. On our way back, Osgood amused himself a good deal over this matter. That we had lost our train did not disturb him. Nothing ever disturbed that comfortable soul, that rare and beautiful spirit. He chuckled over this thing in his happy and contented and almost youthful way all the way back to Liverpool, and said we could add it and trim it up and embroider it and get the little kinsman club together in London over a supper and tell it, and have a good time over it. And while I mourned for the lost train, he invented edition after edition for the story, and richer and ever richer embroideries, and got so much wholesome pleasure out of his work that it was a comfort to see him. At the hotel, we climbed out of the cab and stretched our cramped legs, and Osgood put his hand in his pocket and asked the driver, "How much?"
£12, sir."
£12?
"Yes, sir."
"Why, man, you don't mean pounds, you mean shillings."
"No, sir, it is pounds."
"By your face, you are in earnest, but how do you make it out?"
"You see, sir, it wasn't I that interrupted the job, it was you. I took the job, and I never made any objections. You will allow that yourself, sir. I could have done it in 8 days, call it 80 hours. I am allowed 3 shillings an hour outside of the city. 80 times 3 shillings is...
"Oh, you propose to charge us from here to Balmoral, is that it?"
"You remember it was my orders, sir. And the law..."
"There, don't say any more. I saw myself that this was a good joke on someone. I saw it early, but on account of not waiting till the details were all in, I made an error in locating it. We can't afford to stay here and examine the case in the court, and so, come. We've had you 5 hours. Let's see if we can't arrange a compromise."
The man was willing and proposed £5. Osgood gave him 6. Everybody was satisfied, and there was no ill blood at the parting. We did not gather the kinsmen together in London. Osgood said that a story which you could not add anything to by your fancy and invention wasn't worthwhile, and there did not seem to be any way to add anything to this one. It seemed to be born full-grown. If the cabman had been a German, it could be believable that he did not know that the situation was a humorous one. But he was a Scotchman. There have been Scotchmen who have passed themselves off as being destitute of the sense of humor, but it was no credit to them that they succeeded. They could not have succeeded with intelligent people. I believe that London is the pleasantest and most satisfying village in the world. The stranger soon grows fond of it, and the native lives and dies worshipping it.
It is a most singular and interesting place, and the engaging simplicities of its 50 village populations are an unending marvel and delight to the wandering alien. For instance, he sees 3 or 4 brisk young men come along, idiots apparently, with great loud-colored splotches painted on their faces and wearing fantastic and bright-hued circus costumes. And he will wonder how they can expose themselves like that and not perish with shame, and why they are not jeered at and made fun of and driven to concealment or suicide. But they are not thinking of being ashamed. They are gay and proud, and they hold their heads up and smirk and grimace and gamble along, utterly complacent and happy. And they are not jeered at, but admired. They stop in the middle of the village street and begin to perform. For these sorry animals are comedians. The villagers come to the windows to see and enjoy. The maidservants flock up the area steps in their neat white caps with their flowing white streamers show above the level of the sidewalk. All kinds of humble folk gather and sit on the curbstones on both sides of the street and look glad and expectant. While one comedian brays a comic song, another shuffles off a pathetically rudimentary and ignorant dance to the rattle and thump of a tambourine, a third stands on his head, walks on his hands, throws somersaults and handsprings, and does other innocent little juvenile gymnastics, and the principal ass of the party, the grotesquely dressed clown, awkwardly repeats these marvels after him and pretends to get falls and to hurt himself, and then limps about, rubbing his stomach and ruefully shaking his head, and is so unspeakably and self-consciously and premeditatively and ostentatiously funny that the villagers do nearly expire with laughter over it, instead of lassoing the man and lynching him. Then the comedians play a play of unimaginable simplicity and incoherency and irrelevancy and juvenility, a play that lasts nearly 10 minutes sometimes, and the exhibition is over. All the spectators look pleased and happy and greatly freshened up. The whole performance has lasted 20 or 30 minutes, perhaps, and one comedian or another has passed the hat several times in the meantime. Not to the pit, the curbstone, for it is usually too poor to pay, but to the windows in the area. The solicitor holds up his cap and waltzes about with his beseeching eyes on the windows, and when a penny falls, he jumps and catches it and returns a bow worth $2,000. If there are as many as 4 comedians, and if their costumes are new and smart, the contributions are liberal. Sometimes they foot up 25 or 30 cents for a single performance. But I have seen a troupe consisting of 2 comedians, clothed in old and shabby finery, play 17 minutes and collect only 4 cents. Still, it was enough. It was profitable. It was more than 20 cents an hour, say $2 for the day's work. Those young fellows would probably have found it difficult to earn that much at any ordinary work. Next, the stranger will see 3 or 4 nigger minstrels going along with banjo, bones, and tambourine. They are a sorrier lot than the comedians. They are niggers in nothing, not even in the black paint. For it is too black, or it isn't the right kind. At any rate, it does not counterfeit any complexion known to our southern states, and it is our Negro that is ostensibly represented. The costumes are incredible. They counterfeit no clothes that were ever worn in this planet, or indeed anywhere in the solar system. These poor fellows furnish a comic performance which is so humble, and poor and pitiful and childish and asinine and inadequate that it makes a person ashamed of the human race. Ah, their timorous dances, and their timorous antics, and their shamefaced attempts at funny grimacing, and their cockney nigger songs and jokes. They touch you, they pain you, they fill you with pity, they make you cry. I suppose that in any village but London, these poor minstrels and the comedians would be mercifully taken out and drowned. But in London, no. London loves them. London has a warm, big heart. And there is room and a welcome in it for all the misappreciated refuse of creation. In all the villages of prodigious London, the villagers love music. They love it with a breadth and looseness of taste not known elsewhere but in heaven. If they were up there, they would not shut their ears Sundays when the congregational singing was coming up from below. To them, anything that is a noise is music, and they enjoy it, not in an insipid way, but with a rapt and wholehearted joy, particularly if it is doleful. And there are no people anywhere who are so generous with their money if the music is doleful enough. In London, poor old ragged men and women go up and down the middle of the empty streets, Sunday afternoons, singing the most heartbreakingly desolate hymns and sorrowful ditties in weak and raspy and wheezy voices, voices that are hardly strong enough to carry across the street, and the villagers listen and are grateful and fling pennies out of the windows. And in the deep stillness of the Sabbath afternoon, you can hear the money strike upon the stones a block away. The song drones along as monotonously and as tunelessly as a morning service snore in a backcountry church in the summertime, and I think that nothing could well be more dreary and saddening. But it brings pennies, pennies instead of bricks, and you note that circumstance with surprise and disappointment, or perhaps not exactly disappointment, but something between that and regret. Still, your respect is compelled, partly for the Catholic width of taste that can find room for music like that, and partly for the spirit of benevolence that is in the breast of him who throws the penny. The spirit of benevolence is there, there can be no question about that. There is nothing that is quite so marvelous to the stranger as the free way in which England pours out money upon charities. About half or two-thirds of the time, the objects are unworthy, apparently, but that is no matter. That is nothing to the point. It is the spirit that in many instances is back of the gifts that makes the act fine. Not in all the instances, possibly not even in the majority of them. But after you have put aside the reluctant and involuntary contributions, there are enough of the other sort left to make you wonder and admire and take off your hat. The first flush of enthusiasm over the Queen's approaching Jubilee sent every Englishman's hand into his pocket after money to commemorate with, and he brought it out full and gladly contributed it. The mass of those voluntary contributions was prodigious. It was monumental for vastness. But one is perhaps justified in believing that it was by no means as imposing as the mass of the involuntary contributions which followed it. I was living in London in those interesting months. The journals furnished appetizing reading for the disconnected stranger. Every day, and the day after, and the day following that, and so on, and so on, and so on, week in and week out, the appeals for money filed through their columns in steady and compact procession, and gave one the feeling that all England was marching by and holding out its hat and an axe. The hat in one hand and an axe to grind in the other, a stretch of hats from horizon to horizon on one side along the mighty line of march and of axes on the other. Everybody seemed to have an axe to grind and to recognize that now was his chance, now that his prey could not escape, now that excuses which could save his prey ordinarily would injure him at this time, make him seem unpatriotic, and shame him before his neighbors. The opportunity was the supremest that had presented itself in history, and by all the signs it was being worked with remorseless and devastating industry. Obscure people who wanted to get into notice invented commemorative projects and set them forth in the papers and passed the hat. These projects were uncountable for number and indescribable for variety. They seemed to include every possible contrivance, wise and otherwise, which by any pretext or excuse could be made commemorative of the record reign, and advertise the promoter. Prominent and wise people also came forward with projects. Projects which were good and worthy and not tainted with sordidness and self-seeking. They included statues, drinking fountains, public parks, art galleries, libraries, asylums for the insane, the inebriate, the blind, the dumb, the crippled, the poor, the aged, the orphan, the outcast. Free institutions for the dissemination of all kinds of elevating culture. Institutions for instruction in professional nursing. And hospitals of every conceivable kind and practically without number. On Jubilee Day, the hospitals and hospital annexes subscribed for had multiplied to such a degree that the list of their mere names covered several fine print octavo pages. The money involved was a dizzy figure. And on top of all that, and independent of it, the Prince of Wales's powerful name and popularity gathered in a hospital fund of vast dimensions to reinforce the endowments of the already existent hospitals of London. It is believable that England furnished the money for these great things with little or no reluctance, possibly with even the same spontaneity with which she answered the famine call from India, when she promptly handed out $2.5 million. Although the call fell at a time when all the landscape visible to her from any point by naked eye or telescope consisted of a monotonous plane of hats held out for commemoration assessments. Judging by the clerical appeals in the papers in those days, there were not more than 100 churches in England that had not been in a damaged condition for a generation and needed commemoration repairs, and no church at all that did not need something or other which could be made to do commemorative duty. The diligence of the church seemed to leave all other diligences far behind in the race for commemoration money. The church gave England a harrying such as she had never had before and will not have again until next record reign. It assessed its public for all the serious and ostensibly serious things it could think of, and when that source was exhausted, it turned to humor for assistance. A country clergyman, 92 years old and proportionately obscure, fell dead, whereupon there was a prompt proposition that a fund be raised for a monument. To commemorate him? No. To commemorate the record reign. It is not to be disputed that in matters of charity, the English are by a long way the most prodigal nation in the world. Speaking of this, we now and then, at long intervals, hear incidental mention of George Mueller and his orphanages. Then they pass out of our minds and memories, and we think that they have passed out of the earth. But it is not so. They go on. They have been going on for 60 years, and are as much alive today as ever they were. George Mueller is more than 90 years old now, but he is still at his work. He was poor when he projected his first orphanage for the sustenance of half a dozen waifs. Since then, he has collected and spent $6 or $7 million of dollars in his kindly work, and is as poor today as he was when he started. He has built 5 great orphanages. In them, he clothes and teaches and feeds 2,000 children at a cost of $100,000 a year, and England furnishes the money. Not through solicitation, nor advertising, nor any kind of prodding, but by distinctly voluntary contributions. When money runs short, Mueller prays, not publicly but privately, and his treasury is replenished. In 60 years, his orphans have not gone to bed unfed a single day, and yet many a time they have come within 15 minutes of it. The names of the contributors are not revealed. No lists are published. No glory is to be gained by contributing. Yet every day in the year, the day's necessary requirement of $300 or $400 arrives in the till. These splendid facts strain belief, but they are true. Mark Twain. 4 Sketches About Vienna. These 4 manuscripts, now in the Mark Twain papers, were all written in Vienna in the first half of 1898, near the start of a period during which Clemens seems to have worked more intensively on the autobiography than at any time since 1885. All the manuscripts are specifically dated, February 3rd, May 6th, June 4th, and June 26th, almost as if they were entries in a diary. They are untitled, and with one exception, a group of servants, the titles adopted here were first supplied by Paine. Beauties of the German Language is about something Clemens had decided not to read as part of a lecture he gave on the 1st of February for a public charity. Notebook 40, typescript, page 8, Mark Twain Collection, University of California. The text he declined to read was handed to him as a clipping as he began his lecture, and he pinned it to the last page of this manuscript as an example of his point about the German habit of compounding words. It is actually a traditional, or at least typical, German tongue twister of the kind Hank Morgan invoked in Chapter 23 of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Samuel L. Clemens, 1889. Comment on Tautology and Grammar briefly airs one of Clemens's acknowledged foibles, his preference for the exact word and clarity of statement. A group of servants, which is probably unfinished, records Clemens's secret enjoyment of his wife Olivia's attempts to control the ebullience of one of the servants hired for the house in Kaltenleutgeben, just outside Vienna, where they stayed from late May to mid-October 1898. The servant is dubbed Wuthering Heights, which is not her name, and proves herself a legitimate member of Mark Twain's literary family of incessant talkers from Simon Wheeler onward. A Viennese procession, which highlights Clemens's genuine delight in public ceremony and showy costume, describes a parade in honor of the 50th year of the reign of Emperor Franz Joseph I of Austria, 1830 to 1916, which was also celebrated with an extensive exhibition of industry, commerce, agriculture, and science, Horowitz, 1898. Paine published 3 of these pieces, omitting A Group of Servants, which was first published in 2009. Mark Twain's Autobiography, Part 1, pages 164 to 174. Who is Mark Twain? SLC 2009, pages 61 to 69. Neither included none in his edition. Beauties of the German Language. February 3rd, Vienna. Lectured for the benefit of a charity last night in the Bösendorfer Saal. Just as I was going on the platform, a messenger delivered to me an envelope with my name on it, and this written under it, "Please read one of these tonight." Enclosed were a couple of newspaper clippings, two versions of an anecdote, one German, the other English. I was minded to try the German one on those people just to see what would happen, but my courage weakened when I noticed the formidable look of the closing word, and I gave it up. A pity, too, for it ought to read well on the platform and get an encore. That or a brickbat, there is never any telling what a new audience will do. Their tastes are capricious. The point of this anecdote is a justifiable jibe at the German long word, and is not as much of an exaggeration as one might think. The German long word is not a legitimate construction, but an ignoble artificiality, a sham. It has no recognition by the dictionary and is not found there. It is made by jumbling a lot of words into one in a quite unnecessary way. It is a lazy device of the vulgar and a crime against the language. Nothing can be gained, no valuable amount of space saved by jumbling the following words together on a visiting card. Mrs. Smith, widow of the late commander-in-chief of the police department. Yet a German widow can persuade herself to do it without much trouble. Mrs. late commander-in-chief of the police department's widow, Smith. This is the English version of the anecdote. A Dresden paper, the Weidmann, which thinks that there are kangaroos, Beutelratte, in South Africa, says the Hottentots, Hottentotten, put them in cages, quarter, provided with covers, Lattengitter, to protect them from the rain. The cages are therefore called Lattengitterwetterkotter, and the imprisoned kangaroo Lattengitterwetterkotter Beutelratte. One day an assassin, Attentäter, was arrested who had killed a Hottentot woman, Hottentottenmutter, the mother of two stupid and stuttering children in Strettertrottel. This woman, in the German language, is entitled Hottentottenstrottertrottelmutter, and her assassin takes the name Hottentottenstrottermutterattentäter. The murder was confined in a kangaroo's cage, Beutelrattenlattengitterwetterkotter, whence a few days later he escaped, but fortunately he was recaptured by a Hottentot, who presented himself at the mayor's office with a beaming face. "I have captured the Beutelratte," said he. "Which one?" said the mayor. "We have several." "The Attentäter Lattengitterwetterkotter Beutelratte." "Which Attentäter are you talking about?" "About the Hottentottenstrottertrottelmutterattentäter." "Then why don't you say at once, the Hottentottenstrottelmutterattentäter Lattengitterwetterkotter Beutelratte?" Comment on tautology and grammar. May 6th. I do not find that the repetition of an important word a few times, say 3 or 4 times in a paragraph, troubles my ear if clearness of meaning is best secured thereby. But tautological repetition which has no justifying object, but merely exposes the fact that the writer's balance at the vocabulary bank has run short, and that he is too lazy to replenish it from the thesaurus, that is another matter. It makes me feel like calling the writer to account. It makes me want to remind him that he is not treating himself and his calling with right respect, and, incidentally, that he is not treating me with proper reverence. At breakfast this morning, a member of the family read aloud an interesting review of a new book about Mr. Gladstone, in which the reviewer used the strong adjective delightful 13 times. 13 times in a short review, not a long one. In 5 of the cases, the word was distinctly the right one, the exact one. The best one our language can furnish. Therefore it made no discord. But in the remaining cases it was out of tune. It sharped or flatted one or the other every time, and was as unpleasantly noticeable as is a false note in music. I looked in the thesaurus, and under a single head I found 4 words, which would replace with true notes the false ones uttered by 4 of the misused delightfuls. And, of course, if I had hunted under related heads for an hour and made an exhaustive search, I should have found right words to a shade wherewith to replace the remaining delinquents. I suppose we all have our foibles. I like the exact word, and clarity of statement, and here and there a touch of good grammar for picturesqueness. But that reviewer cares only for the last mentioned of these things. His grammar is foolishly correct, offensively precise. It flaunts itself in the reader's face all along, and struts and smirks and shows off, and is in a dozen ways irritating and disagreeable.
To be serious, I write good grammar myself, but not in that spirit, I am thankful to say. That is to say, my grammar is of a high order, though not at the top. Nobody's is. Perfect grammar, persistent, continuous, sustained, is the fourth dimension, so to speak. Many have sought it, but none has found it. Even this reviewer, this purist with all his godless airs, has made two or three slips. At least I think he has. I'm almost sure, by witness of my ear, but cannot be positive, for I know grammar by ear only, not by note, not by the rules. A generation ago I knew the rules, knew them by heart, word for word, though not their meanings, and I still know one of them, the one which says, but never mind, it will come back to me presently. This reviewer even seems to know, or seems even to know, or seems to know even, how to put the word even in the right place. And the word only, too. I do not like that kind of persons. I never knew one of them that came to any good. A person who is as self-righteous as that will do other things. I know this because I have noticed it many a time. I would never hesitate to injure that kind of a man if I could. When a man works up his grammar to that altitude, it is a sign. It shows what he will do if he gets a chance. It shows the kind of disposition he has. I've noticed it often. I knew one once that did a lot of things. They stop at nothing. But anyway, this grammatical coxcomb's review is interesting, as I said before, and there is one sentence in it which tastes good in the mouth. So perfectly do the last five of its words report a something which we have all felt after sitting long over an absorbing book. The matter referred to is Mr. Gladstone's Boswellized conversations and his felicitous handling of his subjects. One facet of the brilliant talker's mind flashes out on us after another, till we tire with interest. That is clearly stated. We recognize that feeling. In the morning paper I find a sentence of another breed. There had been no death before the case of Cornelius Lean, which had arisen and terminated in death since the special rules had been drawn up. By the context, I know what it means, but you are without that light, and will be sure to get out of it a meaning which the writer of it was not intending to convey. A Group of Servants. June 4th, Kaltenleutgeben. In this family we are four. When a family has been used to a group of servants, whose several terms of service with it covers these periods, to wit 10 years, 12 years, 13 years, 17 years, 19 years, and 22 years, it is not able to understand the new ways of a new group straight off. That would be the case at home. Abroad it is the case emphasized. We have been housekeeping a fortnight now, long enough to have learned how to pronounce the servants' names, but not to spell them. We shan't ever learn to spell them. They were invented in Hungary and Poland, and on paper they look like the alphabet out on a drunk. There are four. Two maids, a cook, and a middle-aged woman who comes once or twice a day to help around generally. They are good-natured and friendly and capable and willing. Their ways are not the ways which we have been so long used to with the home tribe in America, but they are agreeable, and no fault is to be found with them, except in one or two particulars. The cook is a love, but she talks at a gait and with a joyous interest and energy which makes everything buzz. She is always excited. Gets excited over big and little things alike, for she has no sense of proportion. Whether the project in hand is a barbecued bull or a handmade cutlet, it is no matter. She loses her mind. She unlimbers her tongue, and while her breath holds out, you can't tell her from a field day in the Austrian Parliament. But what of it, as long as she can cook? And she can do that. She has that mysterious art which is so rare in the world. The art of making everything taste good, which comes under the enchantment of her hand. She is the kind of cook that establishes confidence with the first meal, establishes it so thoroughly that after that you do not care to know the materials of the dishes nor their names. That her hallmark is upon them is sufficient. The youngest of the two maids, Charlotte, is about 20, strong, handsome, capable, intelligent, self-contained, quiet, in fact, rather reserved. She has character and dignity. The other maid, Wuthering Heights, which is not her name, is about 40 and looks considerably younger. She is quick, smart, active, energetic, breezy, good-natured, has a high-keyed voice and a loud one, talks 13 to the dozen, talks all the time, talks in her sleep, will talk when she is dead.
is here, there, and everywhere, all at the same time, and is consumingly interested in every devilish thing that is going on, particularly if it is not her affair. And she is not merely passively interested, but takes a hand. And not only takes a hand, but the principal one. In fact, will play the whole game, fight the whole battle herself, if you don't find some way to turn her flank. But as she does it in the family's interest, not her own, I find myself diffident about finding fault. Not so the family. It gravels the family. I like that. Not maliciously, but because it spices the monotony to see the family graveled. Sometimes they are driven to a point where they are sure they cannot endure her any longer, and they rise in revolt. But I stand between her and harm, for I adore Wuthering Heights. She is not a trouble to me. She freshens up my life. She keeps me interested all the time. She is not monotonous. She does not stale. She is fruitful of surprises. She is always breaking out in a new place. The family are always training her, always caulking her. But it does not make me uneasy any more now, for I know that as fast as they stop one leak, she will spring another. Her talk is my circus, my menagerie, my fireworks, my spiritual refreshment. When she is at it, I would rather be there than at a fire. She talks but little to me, for I understand only about half that she says, and I have had the sagacity not to betray that I understand that half. But I open my door when she is talking to the executive at the other end of the house, and then I hear everything. And the enjoyment is without alloy, for it is like being at a show on a free ticket. She makes the executive's head ache. I am sorry for that, of course. Still, it is a thing which cannot be helped. We must take things as we find them in this world. The executive's efforts to reconstruct Wuthering Heights are marked by wisdom, patience, and gentle and persuasive speech. They will succeed, yet, and it is a pity. This morning at 8:30, I was lying in my bed, counterfeiting sleep. The executive was lying in hers, reasoning with Wuthering Heights, who had just brought the hot water and was buzzing around here and there and yonder, preparing the baths and putting all manner of things to rights with her lightning touch, and accompanying herself with a torrent of talk, cramped down to a low-voiced flutter to keep from waking me up. "You talk too much, Wuthering Heights, as I have told you so often before. It is your next worst fault, and you ought to try your best to break yourself of it. Indeed, yes, Gnädige Frau, it is the very truth you are speaking. None knows it better than I, nor is sorrier. Jesus, but it is a verdammtest defect. As in your goodness you have said yourself these 50 times, and don't! I never use such language, and I don't like to hear it. It is dreadful. I know that it means nothing with you, and that it is common custom and came to you with your mother's milk. But it distresses me to hear it, and besides, you are always putting it into my mouth, which... Oh, bless your kind heart, Gnädige Frau! You won't mind it in the least after a little. It's only because it is strange and new to you now that it isn't pleasant. But that will wear off in a little while, and then... Oh, it's just one of those little trifling things that don't amount to a straw, you know. Why, we all swear, the priest and everybody, and it's nothing, really nothing at all. But I will break myself of it, I will indeed. And this very moment will I begin, for I have lived here and there in my time and seen things and learned wisdom. And I know better than a many another that there is only one right time to begin a thing, and that is on the spot. Ah, yes, by God, as your grace was saying only yesterday. There, do be still. It is as much as a person's life is worth to make even the triflingest remark to you. It brings such a flood. And any moment your chatter may wake my husband, and he... After a little pause to gather courage for a deliberate misstatement, he can't abide it. I will be as the grave. I will indeed, for sleep is to the tired, sleep is the medicine that heals the weary spirit. Heilige Mutter Gottes, before I be still to befill. If still... After a little pause, the executive began a tactful and low-temperature lecture which had all the earmarks of preparation above it. I know that easy impromptu style and how it is manufactured, for I have worked at that trade myself. I have forgotten to mention that Wuthering Heights has not always served in a subordinate position. She has been housekeeper in a rich family in Vienna for the past 10 years. Consequently, the habit of bossing is still strong upon her, naturally enough. The cook and Charlotte complain that you interfere in their affairs. It is not right. It is not your place to do that.
Oh, Joseph and Mary, Deuteronomy and all the saints, think of that. Why, of course,
When the mistress is not in the house, it is necessary that somebody...
No, it is not necessary at all. The cook says that the reason the coffee was cold yesterday morning was that you removed it from the stove, and that when she put it back, you removed it again.
Ah, but what would one do, gnädige Frau? It was all boiling away.
No matter. It was not your affair. And yesterday morning you would not let Madame Blanc into the house and told her no one was at home. My husband was at home. It was too bad, and she had come all the way from Vienna. Why did you do that?
Let her in? I ask you, would I let her in? And he hard at his work and not wishing to be disturbed, sunk in his labors up to his eyes and grinding out God knows what, for it is beyond me, though it has my sympathy, and none feels for him more than I do when he is in his lyings in that way. Now would I let her in to break up his work in that idle way, and she with no rational thing in the world to pester him about? Now could I?
How do you know what she wanted? The shot struck an unprotected place and made silence for several seconds, for W.H. was not prepared for it and could not think of an answer right away. Then she recovered herself and said,
Well, it was like this. Well, she... Of course, she could have had something proper and rational on her mind, but then I knew that if that was the case, she would write. Not come all the way out here from Vienna to...
Did you know she came from Vienna?
I knew by the silence that another unfortified place had been hit. Then,
she had that kind of a look which you have noticed upon a person when
what?
She had that kind of a look anyway, for...
How did you know my husband did not want to be disturbed?
Know it? Oh, indeed, and well I knew it, for he was that busy that the sweat was leaking through the floor. And I said to the cook, said I...
He didn't do a stroke of work the whole day, but sat in the balcony smoking and reading.
In a private tone, touched with shame, reading his own books, he is always doing it.
You should have told him. He would have been very glad to see Madame Blanc, and was disappointed when he found out what had happened. He said so himself.
Oh, indeed, yes, dear gnädige Frau. He would say it, that he would, but give your heart peace. He is always saying things which... Why, I was saying to the butcher's wife no longer ago than day before yesterday. Ruhig!
And let me go on. You do twice as much of the talking as you allow me to do, and I can't have it.
If... It's Viennese, gnädige Frau. Custom, you see, that's just it. We all do it. It's Viennese.
But I'm not Viennese, and I can't get reconciled to it. And your interruptions, why, it makes no difference. If I am planning with the cook, or commissioning a dienstman, or asking the postman about the trains, no matter, you break right in, uninvited, and take charge of the whole matter. And,
Jesus, it's just as I was saying. How true was the word. It's Viennese. All over Viennese. Custom, you see, all custom. Zorl Blagresnetgorskovitz, she's the Princess Tubesnetchepovich's maid, she says she always does so, and the princess likes it, and...
But I am not the princess, and I want things my way. Can't you understand a simple thing like that? And there's another thing. Between the time that the three of us went to Vienna yesterday morning and 10 at night when we returned, you seem to have had your hands over full. When the cook's old grandfather came to see her, what did you meddle for?
A Viennese procession. June 26th, Sunday. Kaltenleutgeben. I went in the 8 o'clock train to Vienna to see the procession. It was a stroke of luck, for at the last moment I was feeling lazy and was minded not to go. But when I reached the station, 5 minutes late, the train was still there. A couple of friends were there also, and so I went. At Leasing, half an hour out, we changed to a very long train and left for Vienna with every seat occupied. That was no sign that this was a great day, for these people are not critical about shows. They turn out for anything that comes along. Half an hour later, we were driving into the city. No particular bustle anywhere, indeed less than is usual on an Austrian Sunday. Bunting flying and the decoration here and there, a quite frequent thing in this Jubilee year. But as we passed the American Embassy, I saw a couple of our flags out, and the minister and his men servants arranging to have another one added. This woke me up. It seemed to indicate that something really beyond the common was to the fore. As we neared the bridge which connects the first berserk with the third, a pronounced and growing life and stir were noticeable.
and when we entered the wide square where the Schwarzenberg Palace is, there was something resembling a jam. As far as we could see down the broad avenue of the park ring, both sides of it were packed with people in their holiday clothes. Our cab worked its way across the square and then flew down empty streets all the way to Liebenberggasse number 7, the dwelling we were aiming for. It stands on the corner of that street and the park ring, and its balconies command a mile stretch of the latter avenue. By a trifle after 9, we were in the shade of the awnings of the first-floor balcony with a dozen other guests and ready for the procession. Ready, but it would not start for an hour yet, and would not reach us for half an hour afterward. As to numbers, it would be a large matter, for by report it would march 25,000 strong. But it isn't numbers that make the interest of a procession. I have seen a vast number of long processions which didn't pay. It is clothes that make a procession. Where you have those of the right pattern, you can do without length. 2 or 3 months ago, I saw one with the emperor and an archbishop in it, and the archbishop was being carried along under a canopied arrangement and had his skull cap on, and the venerable emperor was following him on foot and bareheaded. Even if that had been the entire procession, it would have paid. I am old now and may never be an emperor at all, at least in this world. I've been disappointed so many times that I'm growing more and more doubtful and resigned every year. But if it ever should happen, the procession will have a fresh interest for the archbishop, for he will walk. The wait on the balcony was not dull. There was the spacious avenue stretching into the distance, right and left to look at, with its double wall of massed humanity, an eager and excited lot, broiling in the sun, and a comforting spectacle to contemplate from the shade. That is, on our side of the street they were in the sun, but not on the other side, where the park is. There was dense shade there. They were good-natured people, but they gave the policemen plenty of trouble, for they were constantly surging into the roadway and being hustled back again. They were in fine spirits, yet it was said that the most of them had been waiting there in the jam 3 or 4 hours, and 2/3 of them were women and girls. At last, a mounted policeman came galloping down the road in solitary state, first sign that pretty soon the show would open. After 5 minutes, he was followed by a man on a decorated bicycle. Next, a marshal's assistant sped by on a polished and shiny black horse. 5 minutes later, distant strains of music. 5 more, and far up the street the head of the procession twinkles into view. That was a procession. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. According to my understanding, it was to be composed of shooting match clubs from all over the Austrian Empire, with a club or two from France and Germany as guests. What I had in my imagination was 25,000 men in sober dress, drifting monotonously by with rifles slung to their backs. A New York target excursion on a large scale. In my fancy, I could see the colored brothers toting the ice pails and targets and swabbing off perspiration. But this was a different matter. One of the most engaging spectacles in the world is a Wagner opera force marching onto the stage, with its music braying and its banners flying. This was that spectacle infinitely magnified, and with the glories of the sun upon it and the countless multitude of excited witnesses to wave the handkerchiefs and do the hurrahing. It was grand and beautiful and sumptuous, and no tinsel, no shams, no tin armor, no cotton velvet, no make-believe silk, no Birmingham Oriental rugs. Everything was what it professed to be. It is the clothes that make a procession. And for these costumes, all the centuries were drawn upon, even from times which were already ancient when Kaiser Rudolf himself was alive. There were bodies of spearmen with plain steel casks of a date 1,000 years ago, other bodies and more ornamental casks of 1 century or 2 later, and with breastplates added. Other bodies with chainmail elaborations, some armed with crossbows, some with the earliest crop of matchlocks. Still other bodies clothed in the stunningly picturesque plate armor and plumed great helmets of the middle of the 16th century. And then there were bodies of men-at-arms in the darling velvets of the Middle Ages, and nobles on horseback in the same, doublets with huge puffed sleeves, wide brigand hats with great plumes, and the rich and effective colors. Old gold, black and scarlet, deep yellow, black and scarlet, brown, black and scarlet. A portly figure clothed like that with a two-handed sword as long as a billiard cue and mounted on a big draft horse finely caparisoned, with the sun flooding the splendid colors. A figure like that with 50 duplicates marching in his rear is procession enough all by itself. Yet that was merely a detail. All the centuries were passing by. Passing by in glories of color and multiplicities of strange and quaint and curious and beautiful costumes not to be seen in this world now outside the opera and the picture books. And now and then, in the midst of this flowing tide of splendors, appeared a sharp contrasting note. A mounted committee in evening dress, swallowtails, white kids, and shiny new plug hats. And right in their rear, perhaps 100 capering clowns in thunder and lightning dress. Or a band of silken pages out of ancient times, plumed and capped and daggered, dainty as rainbows, and mincing along in flesh-colored tights. And as handy at it, too, as if they had been born and brought up to it. At intervals, there was a great platform car, bethroned and grandly canopied, upholstered in silks, carpeted with oriental rugs, and freighted with girls clothed in gala costumes. There were several military companies dressed in uniforms of various bygone periods. Among others, one dating back a century and a half, and another of Andreas Hofer's time and region. Following this latter was a large company of men and women and girls dressed in the society fashions of a period stretching from the Directory down to about 1840, a thing worth seeing. Among the prettiest and liveliest and most picturesque costumes in the pageant were those worn by regiments and regiments of peasants from the Tyrol and Bohemia and everywhere in the empire. They are of ancient origin, but are still worn today. I have seen no procession which evoked more enthusiasm than this one brought out. It would have made any country deliver its emotions, for it was a most stirring sight to see. At the end of this year, I shall be 63, if alive, and about the same if dead. I have been looking at processions for 60 years, and curiously enough, all my really wonderful ones have come in the last 3 years. One in India in 96, the Queen's record procession in London last year, and now this one. As an appeal to the imagination, an object lesson synopsizing the might and majesty and spread of the greatest empire the world has seen, the Queen's procession stands first. As a picture for the eye, this one beats it. And in this regard, it even falls no very great way short, perhaps, of that Jaipur pageant. And that was a dream of enchantment. In August 1898, after several months of intensive work on his autobiography, Clemens decided to write up how he came to publish what he called his first magazine article about the burning at sea of the clipper ship Hornet. At the end of August, he told Henry Harper, "I want to write a magazine article of a reminiscent sort. The first magazine article I ever published appeared in Harper's Monthly 31 years ago under the name of, by typographical error, Max Swain. Can you send it to me?" Harper must have sent him tear sheets of 43 Days in an Open Boat, which had been published in the December 1866 issue of Harper's several months before Clemens published his first book, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and Other Sketches. 43 Days was not, of course, Mark Twain's first magazine article, since he had already published dozens of articles in the Californian and in several East Coast journals. But it was the first non-fictional work he had published in so eminent a journal as Harper's. And even though it was by no means humorous, it obviously followed upon his decision the previous year, in October 1865, to seriously pursue a literary career. The lengthy manuscript that Clemens wrote in October 1898 is now in the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale. His Vienna typist, Marian von Kendler, made a typescript of it, now lost, which Clemens revised and eventually published in the November 1899 issue of The Century magazine. The Century publication made no mention of the autobiography, but the original manuscript shows that Clemens initially regarded the article as part of that work. "This is chapter 14 of my unfinished autobiography, and the way it is getting along, it promises to remain an unfinished one." Before the manuscript was typed, he revised "unfinished" to "unpublished" and deleted the words following "autobiography." In February 1899, when he submitted the revised typescript to Century editor Richard Watson Gilder, he claimed he had "abandoned my autobiography and am not going to finish it. But I took a reminiscent chapter out of it and had it typewritten, thinking it would make a readable magazine article." The article, which Clemens subsequently revised again at the request of one of the Hornet passengers, was collected in The Man That Corrupted Hadleyburg and Other Stories and Essays, 1900,
and My Debut as a Literary Person with Other Essays and Stories, 1903. The text that follows here is a critical reconstruction based on the manuscript and revised as Clemens published it in the Century, not as it was reprinted in 1900 and 1903. In 1906, Clemens considered including the piece in his autobiographical dictation of the 20th of February, noting in pencil on the typescript, "Insert here my account of the Hornet disaster, published in the Century about 1898 as being a chapter from my autobiography." For several reasons, that instruction cannot be carried out. But it shows that the piece was among those Clemens considered including in the final form of his autobiography, and it is therefore included in this section of preliminary drafts. Neither Paine nor Nider published this text.